The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
We ask questions like, what is the source of the executive privilege and how is it examined? Is a president who is sitting in office indictable for criminal conduct at all? Can he use the pardon power to excuse himself? One of my favorite lectures, in an odd sense, is looking at the president's ability, and it's not really a legal question, but it is unique to the president, the president's ability to change the public conversation and to use the bully pulpit, as President Trump does so masterfully, to demonize his opponents and change the discussion. He, for example, is fond of calling the Mueller investigation a witch hunt. Turns out that Richard Nixon used the exact same words, you know, more than 45 years ago.
I'm Michaela Fogel, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 10th, 2018. With the firing of Jeff Sessions and his replacement with former U.S. Attorney Matt Whitaker, all eyes this week are focused on whether Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 election and possible coordination between the Trump campaign and the Russians will get to run its full course. But even before the Sessions firing, Benjamin Wittes and Paul Rosenzweig had inquiries into the president on their minds. On Tuesday morning, they sat down to discuss Paul's recent 12-part lecture series on presidential investigations released through the online educational platform, The Great Courses. They talked about how Paul structured the lecture series, Paul's own experience on independent counsel Ken Starr's team investigating the Clinton White House, and the course's relevance to the Mueller investigation. Check the course out at www.thegreatcourses.com. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 363, Paul Rosenzweig on Investigating American Presidents.
Paul, normally when The Great Courses or The Great Courses Plus show up on podcasts, it's because they're advertising on them. I started listening to this series because you had done it, and it suddenly occurred to me, wow, if this were a book, we would certainly do a podcast about it. And so I wanted you to come in kind of to talk about this as though it were written product. But for those listeners who don't know what this format is, first of all, let's just start with what is The Great Courses and what is this series?
Well, The Great Courses is an audio and video learning system, mostly for adults. It's run by a company called The Teaching Company, and it started with the great lectures from professors of Roman history or English philosophy or literature, whatever. First course I took on it was an 84-lecture American history course, which was really kind of something. So it is available for anybody to purchase either audio through the Great Courses Plus, which is their app, or through Audible, for example. If you download and listen through Audible, you can buy it direct from the company as an entire series and get a discount instead of buying it one by one. And it also releases in video format. So if you really burn to see me doing the lectures, you can do it. So we released the product, Investigating American Presidents, in digital form only about 3 weeks ago so that it would be available for the elections. And the hard CDs and DVDs will be available next week for purchase as well.
So tell us about the specific series. This is not the first lecture series that you've done for the teaching company, but this one is exceptionally timely in the current moment. So just tell us, like, what it is and what you did.
Well, you're right. It is timely, and that's a little unusual for the teaching company. As I said, a lot of what they teach are, the verities of the great canons of literature or religion or history or philosophy. But this one seemed an immensely timely topic, and one that, you know, as listeners on Lawfare know, I had some experience with in the Clinton investigation, and had been writing and talking about it a lot actually on Lawfare and in our podcasts and in the blog. And so I realized that there was really an appetite for this. Investigating American Presidents is a 12-lecture series that is one part the philosophy of American government and political science, checks and balances, a one part history, how we have done investigations of presidential misconduct in the past, and then one large part about the law and policy that governs investigations generally and how they might apply in contemporary circumstances. We look, for example, in one lecture at the question of whether or not a sitting president may be indicted while in office. We look at one lecture on executive privilege and another lecture on what it is, what we can say about the law, policy, and history of impeachment. The theory of the course, if you will, is really that a lot of this space, this law and policy space, is contested and disputed. But the best way for any American citizen who wants to engage in the topic to begin is to try and situate it in an existing body of law, policy, and practice. I guess that makes me a conservative in a small C sort of way, and start go from there to answering questions about how these issues might be resolved in contemporary politics.
Who is this pitched to? At what level? So one of the things I was struck by when listening to it, and I've listened, I should say, to the first half of it so far. I will definitely finish it, but I haven't yet. Is that these are not law school lectures, right? These are not lectures sort of at the level of granularity that, for example, when you write on similar subjects in Lawfare, you engage. They're at a somewhat higher level of altitude and covering a pretty wide range. Who's the audience for it?
My goal in this is to speak to the educated listener, the educated American, the average mythical American who has a background in history or English or philosophy and wants to learn something of this topic. I want to be at enough depth that they feel like they've gained a grounding in the intricacies of some of the legal questions, but at a high enough level that they can see it in the context of where it comes from historically and where it comes from in terms of policy judgments that aren't really legal in nature, but more in terms of policy philosophy. Think of it as an extended Washington Post op-ed, and that's kind of my goal for it.
Only without a strongly argued thesis, right? I mean, it's in a lot of ways, it seems more like an effort to sketch the parameters of reasonable debate across a range of issues related to the investigation of presidents.
I think that's right. My goal is to play it as much down the middle as I can. It's no secret my own views on President Trump, but my goal is to kind of define the boundaries of the debate that are reasonable within the grounds of law and policy and history. That means excluding some extreme views as really not plausible, not acceptable. But it also means acknowledging that there is real ambiguity, for example, in the president's power to pardon himself. Though the president's tweeting about that is much derided, it turns out that, and as a matter of text and history, there's actually some provenance to it. And he might not be as foolish in saying that as people have painted him.
So I was trying to think, and as you of all people know, because it's how we originally met, I started my book writing career by writing a book about Ken Starr. And I was, in the context of doing that, I really immersed myself in the literature of these prior investigations. And I was trying to think, what is the closest analog in any form to this project, which is a kind of overview of the history of investigations of presidents, as well as an overview of all of the major issues that those raise. And I can think of the literature on special prosecutors, independent counsels, you know, Katie Harriger, and there's a political science literature and a legal literature there. And I can think of the literature of presidential scandal. And then there are these, like, deep, deep dive books on the individual incidents. But what is the closest thing in your experience? Because I actually couldn't come up with it. Like, what is the, if you were going to say, well, if you're not going to listen to my lecture series, the closest approximation is X piece of literature, what is it? I couldn't think of it.
It is very hard to come up with that. I honestly thought that this was a relatively unique product. The series of books that I think have been most advantageous to me in kind of putting prior presidential investigations in context were the two histories by Ken Gormley, who's now the president at Duquesne. He wrote a beautiful book about Archibald Cox and Leon Jaworski and the Watergate investigation. And he wrote another really fine book called Starr versus Clinton, or maybe it was Clinton versus Starr, that was about that investigation. But he did a good job of kind of situating them within a broader framework. But it doesn't have the history. It doesn't have the political philosophy of the founding. So I don't think there's a good equivalent, which maybe says that I was too generalized and too high level. Who knows?
No, perhaps. I mean, I guess what struck me about it was I was one of the reasons I asked you in to do this podcast is that I was, you know, thinking for those Lawfare readers and listeners who are not immersed in the details, but who are really interested in the broad scope of the Mueller investigation and kind of all of the subsidiary issues that it raises, this struck me as the best overview of that set of issues that I'd ever run across, with the caveat that it is an overview, not a deep dive on any of the specific, like, it's not a comprehensive account of whether the president can be indicted or the scope of the pardon power, but it is remarkably diverse in thinking through from when investigations used to be done by Congress, not by special prosecutors, how that migrated to an executive officer, how for most of that history, the idea that that officer was directly accountable to the president was actually completely uncontested. I just don't know of another sort of general overview of the subject that is sort of as comprehensive, if not as, though I know many that are in every single area more detailed and more granular.
Well, you just made my day. Thank you. No, that's high praise indeed. And that was the objective. The objective here is to take people in this time of tumult, let's call it, who have questions about this and give them a perspective that lets them ask and answer their questions for themselves, but grounded in this idea of history, this idea of past practice. It isn't necessarily determinative, but it strikes me that it is or ought to be a reasonable guide to what we should do now, what has come before.
So let's talk about the specific sort of table of contents, right? It's 13 lectures, of which I've listened to the first six and not the subsequent ones. Walk me through the logic of the course.
Well, I mean, the logic of the course starts out with what I would call a little bit of political theory. The structure of American government is one that devolves a great deal of power to the president. And we kind of talk a little bit about how and why that is. And then it looks to the other two branches of government, the legislature and the judiciary, as checks on the power. The conundrum, as I think it was Madison put it in one of the Federalist Papers that we quote, is to empower the executive and give it energy, but at the same time restrain its lust for power and abuse. And that's the dichotomy that we kind of set out in the first couple of lectures. Then there's what I would call the history arc, the old history of early presidential inquests ranging back to Grant and Harding. I was surprised actually to learn that the very first president who was colorably accused of misconduct in a serious way was George Washington, whom Thomas Jefferson thought had committed treason by entering into the Jay Treaty. And he didn't mean that as a political trope. He meant that as a very serious charge, which was odd to me to learn. We then move forward to what I would call the modern history, the Watergate investigation and the Clinton-Lewinsky Whitewater investigations. We talk in some detail, one lecture on each of those and some of the legal issues. And then we pivot from theory and history to contemporary legal issues. And so there are a host of issues that are unique to the president or to investigations of the president. So not for us a lot of looking at legal issues that anybody would talk about that would apply to you or me, but we ask questions like, what is the source of the executive privilege and how is it examined? What is a president who is sitting in office indictable for criminal conduct at all? Can he use the pardon power to excuse himself? One of my favorite lectures, in an odd sense, is looking at the president's ability, and it's not really a legal question, but it is unique to the president's ability to change the public conversation and to use the bully pulpit, as President Trump does so masterfully, to demonize his opponents and change the discussion. You know, he's for example, is fond of calling the Mueller investigation a witch hunt. Turns out that Richard Nixon used the exact same words, you know, more than 45 years ago to describe the Watergate investigation. So there's a commonality of that. And then we end the lecture series with two lectures on kind of the wrap-up stuff. One is the oddity of public reports about presidential misconduct, since in the normal course of criminality, an investigation that doesn't produce indictments just goes away and there is no public report. Our prosecutors are not public ombudsmen. And then the last lecture about impeachment and what it means to impeach somebody.
So you have been involved in this stuff in a very personal way. And you've also, and for those listeners who don't remember this, Paul was an associate independent counsel.
Senior counsel, please.
under Ken Starr. And in that role was chiefly responsible, I think this is fair to say, chiefly responsible for litigating the attacks on the investigation, right? And so you were sort of the point person to respond to every motion, that every complaint that Starr had leaked grand jury information or behaved unethically in approaching when the investigation first approached Monica. All that stuff was your purview of defending. So you know something about the stresses on these offices. And more recently, you have been a commentator on the Mueller investigation, as have we all, and kind of watched a lot of this happen again with you on the outside, kind of watching it. Have you ever gone over all of this kind of big lens, wide angle lens, history, policy, law before? And what does the process of assembling your thoughts in the form of these 12 lectures teach you about the broad problem that the course is actually about?
I had not had a chance to do that in a comprehensive way before. I had lots of pieces of this, you know, obviously some of them from very recent efforts to dig deep into questions relating to the Mueller investigation for Lawfare and the podcast that we've been doing and some of the writing I've done on the blog as well. But I'd never actually had the opportunity to situate it in the philosophy, the political philosophy of American governance or in its history in quite the same way. Clearly, in some of the things that had gone before, I had had an opportunity to look at the history. For example, the history of the indictability of presidents and what had gone before. But never had I taken all of that and put it up against some of the more distant American history. For example, one of the great things I learned, I literally did not know this until then, was that the first special counsel was appointed by Ulysses S. Grant as part of the Whiskey Ring investigation. And that guy was also the first special counsel fired by a president for getting too close to his friends. In that case, Orville Babcock, the president's personal secretary. And so what I had seen as a fight about Mueller and whether he could be fired reflected maybe through the lens of Watergate and the firing of Archibald Cox actually resonates all the way back to the 1870s and the Whiskey Ring. That was really new to me and quite revelatory and a lot of fun, actually.
I remember the first time I learned that in the Teapot Dome scandal, there were two special counsels appointed, and they were supposed to be like co-special counsel and work together. And the theory of it was that one was a Republican and one was a Democrat, and they would do everything together, which if you think about it from a unitary executive point of view is, you know, dividing executive power. And oddly, it seems to have worked just fine.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have...
Can you imagine it working today?
Right, like sort of like you get... it's hard. It's very hard to imagine. I want to ask you about the roadmap because your last chapter is about reports, and last week and the oddity of special counsels, independent counsels, special prosecutors writing reports at all. And last week, you know, we got released a report of a very different variety. Than we'd seen before, certainly very different from the Starr referral and also very different from the sort of final reports of independent counsels in general. I'm curious, so this is one of the lectures I haven't yet listened to. I'm curious for your thoughts on prosecutors writing reports and your thoughts on this particular report now public after 45 years.
Well, on the general matter of prosecutors writing reports, I think that our experience in the Starr investigation suggests why that's problematic. Prosecutors are good at identifying crime and prosecuting criminality. And one of the reasons that they don't normally engage in public reporting of what they found that doesn't rise to that level is because that they're not particularly well equipped for that. They're not good at being public scolds. They're not good at being public ethicists. And I think that one of the fairest criticisms of the Starr report was that he put himself in the place of legislatures in determining what was impeachable. Now, in some ways, that wasn't his fault because the statute told him to do that. He was obliged to report substantial and credible information that, in his judgment, would be grounds for impeachment. And so they gave him this job, and so he tried to manage it as well as he could. But it turned him from an investigator of criminality into a political figure. By contrast, the Watergate roadmap wasn't that. It was really just the facts. They look like Joe Friday. Just the facts, ma'am. Just the facts. And not even the facts. Just here's a statement of an issue and here's the evidence that bears on it. One of the things that struck me about the roadmap was that it was able to be bare bones like that because the political consensus for impeachment was already building. He didn't need to drive or persuade anybody. By contrast, you know, the Starr report was issued as an argument in favor of impeachment. You know, even though it was couched as here's what you might need to know, it was, you know, here are 11 charges you might consider, which is really pretty argumentative. And partially that was the fact that, Congress had not gone anywhere near the topic. And so I think what's going to be really interesting from those two models as we look forward to the possibility of a Mueller report is which he takes. And that may very well turn on whether or not there becomes a political consensus in Congress, or at least in the House of Representatives, in favor of impeachment, and whether or not, you know, over the next 6 months, the House of Representatives conducts impeachment inquiry. It may or it may not. If it doesn't, then I think a bare bones report might not be adequate to the task, but it may be what I think, and I think it probably is, all that Mueller thinks he can do.
So if you were Bob Mueller and you listened to these 12 lectures, there's no law in these 12 lectures that Bob Mueller doesn't know. There may be some history in there that he doesn't know. And I suspect that there is some kind of constructive ideation that he hasn't, like the sort of thinking about the sort of big sweep of these questions over time that he has not done. What is, from your point of view, the lessons for Mueller of this 12 lectures, and what is the lessons for people watching Bob Mueller of these lectures?
Well, it's a wonderful dream to think that Mr. Mueller might listen to
if
these.
If you're
lectures.
Listening, Bob, it's the Great Courses Plus. You can download it on your phone.
Good, there you go. I think what was most surprising to me from the start of the project to the end was how my view of the constraints of law changed. I began the project thinking that the boundaries were relatively narrow and that there was flexibility and dispute, but that by and large, law had a lot to say about presidential investigations. I ended up thinking that the boundaries were much wider and that a lot of how it's going to be resolved in any presidential investigation comes down to politics and public perception and public will. I'll give you an example. I talk in one of the lectures about the idea of subpoenaing the president. Right? And we all assume that, you know, if a president resisted a subpoena and the courts ultimately ruled against him and said, no, you must respond to that subpoena, a president who respects the rule of law would do so. But I asked the question, what if the president just said no? Even if there were, even in the face of, say, a Supreme Court order to testify or to turn over certain documents, what if a president just said no? Now, in the normal course of life that you and I live in, refusal to honor a subpoena results in a determination of contempt. And if you refuse to purge yourself of contempt, it results ultimately, possibly, in your physical arrest by the U.S. Marshals who put you in jail until you abide the subpoena and turn over the documents or provide the testimony that's demanded of you. And we talk about that at some length. I can't see that happening to a president, any president. I can't see the U.S. Marshals storming the White House in a pitched gun battle with the Secret Service and putting handcuffs on the president to drag him away. So in that instance, the reality is that the ultimate check for a really malfeasant president is only whether or not the body politic, the public and their representatives in Congress would see that as a violation of the rule of law sufficiently grave to warrant impeachment, censure, and removal from office. So where I would have thought before I started this that law determined much of this, I came away thinking that in the end, much of, if not all of how this is resolved is political, or as I put it in the case, one man's witch hunt is another man's righteous enforcement of the rule of law. And it's been that way for every president under investigation since the start of the Republic.
Paul, you're not a relativist, but there's a weirdly relativistic element to that. Are you saying that what makes Nixon a villain is that he lost?
I'm not saying that. Nixon, by my moral standards, was a villain. But I recognize the possibility that he might not have lost. I mean, part of the history of Watergate is that, really, but for the existence of the smoking gun tape, he still had substantial support in Congress that would have prevented him from being impeached. And it was only that and the collapse of his political support that led the leaders in the Senate and the House to pay him a visit and say, it's over. You're done. We will impeach and remove you. So quit now. I don't like that. In fact, I dislike it intensely. And I want a world in which our presidents abide the rule of law, respond to subpoenas, don't demonize their political opponents, and don't trench upon the rule of law in such a way that we doubt it. But the reality is that can happen. And part of the theory of the whole course is that, the only real surety against that is an educated, informed, and engaged American electorate. Hence voting day today.
On that note, the series is Investigating American Presidents. It is produced and made available by the Great Courses Plus, which is not a sponsor of the Lawfare podcast and with whom Lawfare has no financial relationship. Paul, it's a really impressive piece of work, and thank you for coming in and chatting about it. And for listeners who want a kind of overview of not of the Mueller investigation, but of all the issues that are coming up in the context of the Mueller investigation situated in American history, it is a remarkable and valuable series of 30-minute discussions that are both charmingly presented and very informative.
Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Paul for coming on the show. Don't forget to check out his course at thegreatcourses.com. If you haven't yet, please take a moment to share the Lawfare podcast and give us a review and 5-star rating wherever you found us. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.